Thank you. All right. Thanks, everybody, for coming. I am not a horticulturalist. I am an invasive species ecologist. So basically my background, I've looked at the mechanisms that make a particular species successful at being invasive. So we look at different biological traits that help something become get its foothold and become those problem species that have to be managed. Oops. There we go. So Florida, this state is notorious for invasive species. We have some of the most newsworthy invasive species stories in the world. And up in the corner there, you can see one of the giant Burmese pythons. Lionfish are big in the news right now. There's an invasivore movement and whether or not we can eat these things. That's an African giant land snail. These are the snails that you've seen in the news that are eating houses, eating the stucco off the sides of houses. And then here you have a Ligodium invasion. So the animal species might get more of the spotlight, but as you can see by this invasion of Ligodium, the plants are also a huge problem here. To get started, I wanted to just define invasive species. So I wanted to point out that not all non-native species are invasive species. One of the working definitions here is an organism that's not native, and this is the important part. It has negative effects on our economy, our environment, or our health. So you have to have that negative element to be considered an invasive species. What makes Florida so susceptible to these kind of invasions? Florida has a unique geography that essentially with the peninsula and a frost line at the top, Florida almost acts like an island. So once things get in, it's hard. It's that island biogeography kind of phenomenon. And 85% of all non-native species that come into the United States come in through Florida. Most of those coming through the ports in Miami. I've actually heard a new stat on this that it's up to 90% of the non-native species, unconfirmed. But we have 1,400 non-native plant species established in Florida. About 10% of that are present in our natural areas. And the ones that are a problem cause significant impacts to recreation, and they're very expensive to manage. So you can imagine if you're trying to, there's a Melaleuca stand right in the middle there, trying to enjoy the Everglades, it'd be very hard to get through there recreationally. Similarly, this is a water hyacinth. It would be very hard to boat through that or go fishing. So it's very expensive to manage, and it takes the cut into what we get out of recreation dollars. And the estimate, we're in the process of coming up with a more accurate estimate of how much this costs the state per year, but roughly about $25 million per year to control just on public land alone. This doesn't take into account what private landholders are spending and some other conservation lands. So I'm going to take you through some traits of invasive species and the ecology, and then I'll explain what we do at the assessment, and then I'll show you how you can find our results. So biological traits of invasive plants. Typically, you'll find these traits common for a number of the invasive, the heavy-hitting invasive species. So you'll see higher relative growth rates, high seed production, fast germination, tolerance to environments, tolerance to nutrient, either excess nutrients or not enough nutrients, and they're very efficient at resource utilization. And a lot of these things, a lot of these biological traits are common for some of the things that you look for in landscape and horticulture plants. So when you're looking for something that you want to plant in your yard, well, something that's efficient at resource utilization is what you're going to look for. So just to give you some illustration of some of these traits, this is Dioscorea, the air potato. They have very high, this species has very high growth rates. And you can see this is in Broward County, a Dioscorea invasion taking over a live oak tree. High reproduction. The red berries are, if you're not familiar, that is Brazilian peppers. So you can see that's just one tip of a branch. How many seeds that are there? And then this is Ligodium, a close-up of Ligodium. Each one of these little this is a fern, so this puts off spores. So one Ligodium plant can put off millions or billions of spores, possible propagules. They're efficient at dispersal. This is a cedar waxwing eating Russian olive. They eat the fruits, spread them around. Melaleuca up here, those are the capsules on a Melaleuca tree. Anything you do to the tree, if you burn it, if you cut it down, sometimes spraying it, will cause that plant to break those capsules and release those wind-dispersed seeds. And then again, we have water hyacinth, and these things just float around. If they break free, they can float down a canal and take hold and start a new invasion. And I use this for my example of tolerance. This is Chinese tallow tree growing out of a sidewalk. So pretty tolerant species there. So where you have a good a big invasion, you have big ecosystem effects. So you might have erosion, sedimentation, changes in water and nutrients, altered disturbance. Here you can see a Melaleuca fire in the Everglades. Fire adapted community. You know, the typical fires in the Everglades are low intensity fires, but if you throw in Melaleuca, which is full of oils, you get these massive crown fires, very hot fires and very destructive. Add all this stuff together and you end up with changes in stand structure. So you're replacing native species with these non-natives. You're changing the way things are cycling. And so just another tie to horticulture, it's estimated that 60% of non-native species are linked to ornamental plant trade, forestry, and agriculture. This is a book I have. It's from the 70s from University of Florida Press, where they're recommending the planting of coral ardesia, which is newly listed, right? And weeping lantana. And one of the things you can see here, I highlighted one of the attributes is that it's sprawling across the earth, all over the earth. But the majority of these species aren't bad. There's this idea of the tens rule. So 10% of the species that come over that are non-native will become naturalized, and 10% of that will become an invasive species. And many non-native species are economically beneficial. Citrus isn't native. Bottle brush doesn't appear to be a problem, although I'm hearing that it's starting to pop up around Yeehaw Junction. But not all of them are bad. So how do we figure out what species are bad and what species are good? So that you can get the economic benefits from those species that aren't going to be a problem, and weed out the ones that are going to be a problem. So we have the IFAS assessment at University of Florida. Basically, for species that are already present in the state, we have a tool to assess the status of the species, how as it stands in the state. And this reduces costs and increases efficiency of management efforts. So there you see Kogan grass, that's earleaf acacia in the middle, and I've Salvinia giant, yeah. And then we also have a set of tools for species that are not presently in the state, or if there's a new proposed use for that species. And the idea with this is to preemptively prevent future invasions, and that's giant hogweed. And if you don't know anything about giant hogweed, look it up. It's a Victorian garden species that they use in England. But if you get the sap of this stuff on your skin, it's photoreactive. And I've seen the burns. It looks like chemical burns or a third degree burns. It's a really nasty plant. So we would keep that one out of here with the assessment. The assessment was developed in 1999 by the Invasive Plant Working Group. Briefly, it was to alleviate any problems within the university, where you would have one group of people, faculty and staff, saying don't plant this, and another group of faculty and staff saying do plant this. Basically, the conclusions of the assessment have to be referenced if you're recommending plants in the name of University of Florida. And we provide descriptions and recommendations for use and management. And in 2008, we added those tools to do the predictive work. We have the predictive tool and the infra-specific taxon protocol. So briefly, with the status assessment, the state has been divided into three regions, the North, Central, and South. You can have separate recommendations or conclusions for each. You might have a different conclusion for the North than the South. The climate between the North and the South is very different. So we do separate that out. We describe the status of the species based on ecological impacts, the potential for expanded range, how hard is it to manage, and what kind of economic value that species might have. And this one, this tool, we incorporate data from the field. So I cannot go all over the state for every species. We have over 800 species on our list. So we really rely on land managers, other researchers at universities who have firsthand knowledge of how that species is behaving in the environment. So for ecological impacts, we document where the natural areas where they are, how many acres, if it's disturbed or undisturbed habitat, any long-term altercations to ecosystem processes. Is it affecting our threatened or endangered species? And these are just some endangered species in Florida, the Miami blue, a scrub jay, and that's a pawpaw plant. Management impacts, what are the control methods? So there you see a prescribed burn, an aerial spray with a helicopter, and this guy here is, they call it the brontosaurus. So it's literally like a electric pencil sharpener, but you hold it over a tree and it just grinds a tree down to its stump. It's pretty impressive to watch. And is the species difficult? Are you going to have to go back and retreat? Is it greater than $1,500 an acre? So these are all things that we take into account for the management. Here are the possible outcomes. This is the best case is that it's not a problem species and it hasn't been found in natural areas. We can recommend that. For these species, we reassess those in 10 years to make sure that the behavior hasn't changed, the spread hasn't become where we have to change our conclusion. Then we have a caution, may be recommended, but manage to prevent escape. So you want to just exercise caution with these species. For that reason, we reassess those in 2 years because we're not exactly sure 100% if it's bad or if it's good. So we want to go back more often and check this one out. Invasive and not recommended, except for specified and limited use. This also gets reassessed in 2 years, and the specified and limited uses are defined by the Invasive Plant Working Group. As far as I know, we only have one or two species that we have approved uses. And then invasive not recommended. And once you get to this invasive not recommended, you're not going to go back. You can't go from an invasive not recommended to a caution, even if there's an eradication, because that behavior has already shown itself in the state. We're not going to change that. But we do want to keep our records up, so every 10 years we just update our herbarium records and other documentation. The second tool we have is the predictive tool, and this is based on the Australian weed risk assessment. This evaluates species new to the state. We know it causes problems elsewhere, or if it's proposed for a new use. So say there's a species of grass that suddenly is being looked at for biofuels. You're going to change, if you plant it for biofuels, you're going to change that propagule pressure. Where it might have been just a little clump here or there, you're going to plant acres and acres of this. So that's we want to take a second look at it. Dory Gordon has done work to check the accuracy of this protocol and found that it had 90% accuracy on known invasive species and 70% accuracy on known species that are non-native and not a problem. And so far we've looked at over 80 species. I think we're closer to 90 using this tool. The IFAS assessment has looked at those, one of those being Eucalyptus grandis. It's a series of 49 questions. Basically, they break down into history and biogeography and life history ecology. And the scoring, so you have a question, if it's a yes, it might get a 1 or a 2. If it's a no, it might get a negative 1. So you have these different scores based on the questions in the protocol. That cumulative score at the end is how we come up with our recommendations. So anything less than a 1 is a low risk for invasion. Anything greater than 6 is a high risk. And between that 1 and 6, we put that in evaluate further category. And once it's there, we have a secondary screening. It's a simple decision tree, whether it's a tree or tree-like shrub, herb, or low stature shrub, vines have to go through, and we've made the decision to put bamboos through both sides as well, because it's a grass that can grow 30 feet tall, so we might want to go ahead and throw that through both sides of the secondary screen. So some of the traits that have popped out consistently for plants that are failing the assessment, history invasiveness elsewhere is one of the main ones. Broad climate suitability, prolific seed production. There's many questions about dispersal and seed production, and forms dense thickets, allelopathy. So our third tool, this is probably the one that would be the most relevant for the horticulture world, is the infraspecific taxon protocol. And basically this protocol looks at cultivars, varieties, or subspecies, and determines if the recommendations for those resident species would apply. So if you're a species of Lantana, Lantana is listed as an invasive not recommended on our list, but you're coming up with some varieties of Lantana, we're going to put it through this tool to make sure it isn't going to behave like its parent species. Basically, to do this, a request is submitted to IFAS assessment staff. The onus is on you to show us that it isn't going to behave like the parent species. Things that are included in that request are evidence that it's a distinct entity, evidence the taxon will behave differently than the parent species. And this might look familiar. This is the Ruellia, and I'm sorry I did put your credit on there for the pictures. But so with the infraspecific taxon protocol, botanists, field personnel be able to distinguish the taxon. That's one of the first questions. So here you can see the Ruellia simplex. It's kind of this scraggly looking one over there. And this is purple showers, right? Mayan purple, thank you, sorry. So you can see that there's a difference there with those species. Another thing that we look at is whether or not it's going to regress, revert, or hybridize to characteristics of the resident species. So is there going to be cross-pollination? Is this plant in any way going to revert back to show the characteristics of that parent species and in turn become a problem? And we also look at invasive traits that cause greater ecological impacts. Is it going to behave in the environment worse than the parent species? And is there an increase or decrease propagule pressure? So here's the example I have here is Nandina, the resident species. This is heavenly bamboo. The recommendations of the assessment are that it's invasive in north and central Florida and caution in the south. So this is really bad around Gainesville. And we had cultivars that we evaluated. And here you see Firepower, Harbor Dwarf, Gulfstream, and JT Harborbell. So the way that they submitted their reports, we came up with our recommendations. We passed 3 out of 4 of them. And if you'll note, this one down here that did not pass, you see the fruits almost, they look very similar to the parent species. So this whole idea of is it going to behave like its parent species? So we've looked at over 800, I think we're up to 816 on our list. 120 of those are in the reevaluation process right now. But again, this whole not all non-native species are bad. I think this is a great illustration. You can see 69% are not a problem species. 13 are in the caution range, and really 3% are prohibited, and we've got 15 in the area where we're actually saying, based on the data, based on the information, we don't want to recommend this because we think it poses a threat to the environment. And now I'll take you to the website so you can see how you can find out your species in question. And I apologize because this is one of the worst websites I've ever seen in my life. So this website was developed when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, but we are in the process of getting a new website. But I will show you how to get the information based on what we have. We'll work with what we have. So if you go to the IFAS assessment website, where what I've highlighted over here is where you'll find your data, the conclusions page, detailed data, results table, and all that. And just a close up on that, the conclusions page is where you're going to find the recommendations of the IFAS assessment for your species. So click on conclusions by genus, or if you're just interested in the north, central, or south zone, you can see how it breaks down there. But basically, that's what we have. It's a PDF. You have to control F and look for your species or scroll, and I'm sorry. But this is the exciting piece. We have a new website. It's almost finished. It's going to launch this fall. It's going to be way more user-friendly. You can search by species. Right there, that's going to be the header. So right in the middle of the header is going to be a place where you can put, just type in your species and you'll get a sheet that's generated specifically for whatever species you're looking at. We'll also have links on those. So you can go to the EdMaps page, you can go to the FLEPSI page, you can go, like, whatever relevant links about the invasiveness or lack thereof of that species. And you can generate lists. So far, we don't know exactly what that's going to say, but you're going to have a little thing you can click in the top bar, and it'll be almost like you're shopping for shoes. You can say, I want not a problem species in the north zone that's a vine, and you can click, and it'll show you all the species that are non-native that are not a problem. Or you want to see all the prohibited species in the state. It can come up that way. We can generate that list, or the aquatics, or, you know, we're breaking it down based on what we think is going to be the most useful for people coming to our website. So it's very exciting, and I'm super happy about it. but in the meantime, this is our website address there at the top for what I showed before. And we also have a pretty active Twitter account. I post a lot of articles, peer-reviewed journals, and news articles about invasive species in Florida specifically, but also around the world. And we also have a Facebook page. All of that is going to be a little more active once the website's up. So with that, I'd be happy to take your questions. Yeah?
Back to the very beginning, you talked about the cost of management on invasive species being less than $1,500 per acre.
Greater than.
Why is $1,500 a magic number?
I don't. The powers that be came up with these, you know, came up with the tools before I came along. But I think $1,500 an acre is a lot of times you're looking at even greater dollar signs. But again, just another to be continued. But in the next 2 to 3 years, we should have some numbers together about management costs in the state coming out of Luke Florey's lab. So.
Do you have an example of a plant that was on the questionnaire and then 2 years later you visited? You know,
Actually, I forget which zone it was in, but Ruellia was a caution up until last year for, I think, the south zone. And then, so basically in the reevaluation process, I didn't even have to go to the experts for that one because I went to the herbarium records, and you can pull up the herbarium records and see new reports, and in the notes on those herbarium records, it'll say in a long water or in an undisturbed zone. So there were enough new reportings in different counties in South Florida that we bumped it up to invasive, not recommended. Yes?
Are there any species that you're suspicious of that we need to be on the watch for?
Yes. I am actually working, doing a little side project on bamboo. There's a increase in interest in using bamboo for paper. They're trying to do some work with it on biofuels, but they're having problems. The researchers are having problems breaking down the cells or whatever. But I think I've evaluated eight or nine species for paper, and only a couple of them have passed. So what we're doing is doing a side project and looking at as many clumping and running bamboo species as we can to sort of identify the traits that to be on the lookout for. So I would say if you're looking at planting and if you want to plant it in your yard, don't plant a running bamboo because they seem really, really impossible to control. And the clumpers are a little easier to handle. Yeah?
Yeah, in the website itself, do you have anything that says, okay, this species is invasive, but these cultivars are approved for use?
Well, the cultivars will be listed separately. So, like, I think those Nandinas, we'll have Nandina and Domestica. What we could do is we could link the cultivars, you know, in those useful links. But if you wanna talk to me about that, think about a way to. Right.
Right. Right.
Here are alternatives, or yeah. No, I think that's a great idea, and it didn't cross my mind, and I'll take that to my guy, and we're in the process of. Yeah. Absolutely. No, that's great. Thank you. Oh.
Do you know where that landed?
That's a great segue.
Very
good. All right. I thought I could provide that.
Well, let's give you a hand.
Thank you.
Safeguard the natural areas in Florida. Let me move along here now.